You can't do it.
Well, I went to a couple of write-ins. It wasn't last year, it was like the year before for NaNoWriMo here in Holland. And you know, it's a really cool group of people that I really appreciated being invited to it, but they were all like chatting and drinking coffee and eating cookies and stuff. And I'm here with my laptop. I'm like, dude, I've got to hit this 1800 words today. There's no way I'm going to do that if I'm talking to you.
Yeah.
So, but some people are like that. Some people have the ability to, I think that a lot of moms are amazing at that because there's so much they have to juggle in the house that the husband is not doing for them, that they're just able to concentrate amidst all the chaos. And I am envious of that because I cannot. Like if I'm talking on the phone, my wife always wants to say something to me to, you know, like, oh, tell him this, tell him this. And instantly, as soon as I hear another noise, it's like everything just went out the window. I don't even know who I'm talking to anymore. I don't know what's happening anymore. Oh, well, welcome everyone to a special spooky edition of Spilling Ink. This is not Halloween. We missed it by a couple of days. It would have been awesome to do a Halloween episode, but
You're still good. It's Dia de Muertos
oh
in Mexico, so you're good.
beautiful, beautiful. See, we're still celebrating everybody. It's the Day of the Dead. We're very happy about that. And we have two wonderful guests that have actually been on the show as a couple once before. Mr. Andy, is it Penguin? No. Peliquin and Craig DeLuey. We are so happy to have you two gentlemen back. Thank you so much for joining
Thanks
us
for having us
tonight.
back.
Oh yeah.
Oh, it's going to be fun. And tonight is an extra special night because tonight is the Spilling Ink Villains Edition. Yes. And we have our chief villain right over there. Miss,
Me?
how do
No,
I point that direction? Come on. Katie Salitis, she's over there. So I don't know what my hands are doing.
I am sweet and innocent, damn it. Don't you forget it.
Sweet and innocent. Oh my Lord. And you see how she put that scarf on to make herself look sweet and innocent. But we all know better, people.
With my skulls. I've got my little sugar skulls.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Oh, you know what? I should have borrowed. Abby actually had this plague doctor mask that she wore for Halloween. I totally should
Ooh,
have
they're
borrowed it.
cool.
Yeah, those are great. I was happy to see her get that. I was like, oh yeah, rocking the steampunk out. Good deal.
Anybody dress up for Halloween?
No.
No.
Tired middle-aged dad costume I wear every
Yeah.
day.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
I dressed up as part of the couch.
Ooh, nice.
There you go.
You know, like in Mexico, Halloween is not really a thing. I've been living in Mexico basically for the last 16 years until last year. So Halloween was never a thing. Dia de Muertos, Day of the Dead, was huge. That was when people they would dress up and go out and stuff. And so I think in the last few years, Mexico has sort of more adopted the American version of Halloween because of the candy, essentially. The kids just want their candy. But yeah, so it's like Halloween and Thanksgiving are two holidays that are huge here where I am now in Canada, and I've never celebrated them. They've never been a thing for me.
Now, Canada has a different Thanksgiving than the US.
Yeah, October something or another.
Because the harvest is earlier.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay, so yeah, you guys will be having Thanksgiving then pretty soon.
Oh,
Or no,
yeah.
sorry, it's November. That's right. It's Nano month. Any of you guys doing Nano this month?
No.
I don't know. Every month's
I write that much anyways. I don't need Nano.
You know, the concept of NaNoWriMo is awesome for a lot of people, but for me, it was never really a thing. It was like, you know, if I can't write 60,000 words, I can't write 60,000 words. If I can write more than 60,000 words, I'm just going to keep writing this story. I don't know. I guess I've been doing this long enough that I sort of approached it with the professional attitude from I'm going to sit down and put in the work every day from the beginning. So I wasn't the kind of people who needed, you know, okay, this is the month where I push myself really hard. I was always pushing myself as hard as I could.
Same here. But I get it though that some people get value out of it.
Yeah.
It's not, I have no problem with it.
I've started expanding my freelance services into author coaching. And so this year I'm participating a lot more in Nano just on the coaching aspect of it. I'm running with Press this month on Wednesdays and Saturdays so that I get people motivated to write. Because like you said, some people do need that
Yeah.
motivation to get the story out. And it's patient. It takes sitting down in the chair and writing. And if Nano provides that for somebody and gets them to finish that story, I think it's great.
whatever it takes. Yeah.
Well, and I've pushed really hard in years past, and you know, it was fun and challenging and stressful and all that you expect it to be. And I think that it is really a cool tool for people to be able to say, you know, now I can direct my focus because I have a reason. Kind of like people who don't start running until you have a 5K planned or a 10K planned. And you say, okay, well, now I have a goal, so I better get my ass in gear and do this. And so I think it's great for that. But like this year for me, I just don't want to deal with the stress of it. It's like, you know, when I have time to write, I write as hard as I can. And then there might be 2 days where I can't write at all because I'm busy with kid stuff or with work stuff. And so, I don't know. I just don't want to put myself through the
grind. It should be a useful tool that helps you accomplish your art. It shouldn't be an end in itself.
For sure. For sure.
And I think for some people, it ends up being an end in itself. And there's this whole competitive aspect to it or whatever. It's, I don't think that's actually healthy for the writing process. But if it's being used as a tool to jumpstart a project or become a better writer, then great. It's all, I'm all for it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that sort of gamification of it can I mean, gamification is a huge psychological tool that people use for video games, movies, TV shows, like everything. Even, you know, you can find games for running apps, or health tracker apps. And so it has psychological merits. So for some people, it could definitely work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Well, and I see that we've got a couple people on that have been commenting. We've got Anita Stewart and Mike Feria. I have to apologize to Mike again because I made him so sad and so frustrated. A couple weeks ago, he had sent me a message. And I'm not sure what we were talking about, but he had asked about Katie. And like a total a-hole, I told him that Katie had been in a fatal car accident and she was no longer with us. And it was supposed to be a funny prank, but it wasn't very funny to Mike. And he and his wife were pretty upset about it. So, Mike, I am sorry. I won't mess with you like that again. I know, it was terrible. But, yes.
That's anyway. My kind of evil right there. And he's a villain. Look at this.
I know. It was just one of those nights where I was feeling extra feisty on the couch. I'm like, ooh, I'm gonna write people. Well, speaking of villains, we're talking about villains tonight. How did we get onto this conversation? What were we talking about last time that led to villains?
The lead-in from the last conversation where you guys were both wanting to jump on a villain, but we just didn't have time.
Well, we were saying we'd be happy to do this, do another show with you guys because it was so much fun last time, and I particularly had a great time with Andy as a co-guest, and we were talking about what the topic might be, maybe drilling down into something specific, and Andy, you had mentioned that you had done a talk on villains, and that's how we ended up with the topic. It's a great topic.
Well, we've got a good audience listening right now, so I think we should dive into it. And if we get some questions, we'll pop them up here on the screen.
Welcome, everyone.
Oh, Mike, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
He's not gonna forget or forgive that one anytime soon.
A friend of mine, she has one of those Ring doorbells. And it can take video. And so Halloween night, she was basically posting the videos of all the people she scared at her doorway. She's got one of these scarecrows that pops up and yells whenever somebody gets too close. And at first it was funny because she was looking at the teenagers who were all trying to like dive in and get handfuls of candy and getting the shit scared out of them. And then there's this poor little kid just standing there crying. And I couldn't help it. I was laughing. I was laughing so hard. Of all the ones, that was the funniest.
Well, and you know, my favorite one of those, and this was many years ago on like a, what was it called? The Funniest Videos television show that was always on, America's Funniest Video, something like that.
Yeah.
And it was the same thing where it was actually a guy that was dressed as a scarecrow, and it was a real guy. And when kids would come up, he'd jump up and scare the crap out of them. Only he did that to this one young man who came to the door. And instead of being scared, this kid's response was, it was not flight, it was fight. And he clocked him right in the face. I was like, oh my God. But I was like, oh, that's amazing. You're going to get that at one point.
Video. I've seen that before.
There's lots of those, like the scare, you know, the pranks where people like pop out of the dumpster and the guy just reaches around and punches them or something. Yeah.
Yep. So that's a guy with reflexes right there. Well, so villains. Now let me ask you all of this. Wait, what happened to Craig?
I'm having a technical issue with the camera, so I'm actually gonna Andy, you cover for me. I'm gonna jump out and come back. How's that sound?
All right.
So what defines a villain? What makes a villain a villain?
So I like to separate the two between antagonists and villains. There's actually very, very few villain types in the sense of villain is something that's traditionally evil, to the sense of their motives are evil, their actions are evil, and so everything about them is evil. And there's not that many of them because, you know, humans aren't evil in the traditional sense, or in, you know, the fictionally traditional sense. It's hard to find someone who's straight up evil. You know, like one of the classic examples of an evil villain would be a bully, right? Bullies, for all of the hardships that they go through, the fact that they are bullying people, that is sort of an evil action. And they do it and they enjoy it and they like the power it gives them. So there is a sense of evil to that. But otherwise, it's really hard to find someone who's a straight up villain. A sadist would be another one. But you get a lot more antagonists. You know, you've got abusive authority figures. You've got career criminals. You've got henchmen. You know, there's all kinds of things. So it's really hard to narrow it down and find just one villain type. Or, you know, even I think I made a list of sort of the all of the villain and antagonist types that I could come up with, and there's only like 8 villains, and most of them are like, you know, forces of evil, like demons, which, as we all know, you know, there's no demonic forces invading the world in that sense, so it's very fictional. Or, you know, sort of the ancient god of evil, you know, the satanistic archetype from mythology or legends and things like that. But in real life, they're probably the only one that would truly be considered evil is a sadist, someone who derives that sort of pleasure from inflicting physical or psychological pain. Otherwise, every other real person would just be more of an antagonist, someone who goes, you know, who inflicts pain on the people through their actions. Maybe they're not even necessarily bad. They're simply giving the main character, the protagonist, crap or opposing them some way.
Yeah, that's the baseline in the story, is that the villain is always the one stopping the hero of the story from achieving whatever their goal is.
Yeah.
But and I think that I understand what you're saying here, Andy, because what we've always said is that, you know, even the quote unquote bad guy is, you gotta remember that they are the hero in their own story. So, but in the case of a villain, it sounds like that's a person who really is truly, you know, evil, so to speak. That's not just following their own plot line. They're actually bad.
So the truth is that it's nearly impossible to have a villain who is straight up villain, like all evil, like I said. I don't like the thing of a villain as the hero of their own story, because a lot of people aren't really like, they don't want to be, like, it's not about heroism for them. For me, I actually got a tattoo and it says, there is no evil. There's only desire and what you'll do to obtain it. And for me, that's what it comes down to.
Lord Voldemort. I like it.
Yeah, it was, I think I had the idea and then I read the Harry Potter after that and it kind of made it click. It's like, no matter who you are, when you have this desire, most of us follow these socially acceptable paths to get there. The ones who go beyond, who do whatever it takes, who are willing to hurt people, who inflict their desires on other people, those are the ones who become the, not evil, but in essence, they are the ones who embody this concept, this moral concept of good versus evil.
You know, in reading Craig's book, Our War, and I just want to say again to anybody listening or watching that Our War was phenomenal. I mean, it shook me up bad, and it was just a damn good book. But even in that book, there are two sides to this story. And one thing that was interesting is that Craig never really came out in this book and said, this is the right side, this is the wrong side. We had point of view characters on both sides of this battle, both sides of this conflict. And even when I was in the point of view of whom I considered to be the bad guy or the antagonist, I really appreciated that I could see their point of view and that it was being explained and that they actually had goals and hopes and a past and wanted a future. And they weren't just this, you know, bad guy. They weren't just Thanos up in the sky before we had any idea what the hell he was trying to do. They were actual people. They just happened to be on the opposite side of the conflict. And I think that that's an interesting distinction between, you know, someone who's an antagonist and someone who is an actual villain. But Craig, let me throw this to you. What do you think makes a villain, sir?
Well, I think that an antagonist can be villainous and can be the villain of a story, but doesn't have to be. I think I've had technical difficulties. I was out there for a while, but Andy, I think I heard you saying that the antagonist doesn't have to be evil. This is a person who has the same external goals as the protagonist, resulting in conflict. Okay, so. And thematically, you could take that further to say that the protagonist has a certain flaw and they're going to go through their character arc of change. And if it's a positive character arc, they're going to end up a better person by the end of the book because they stop believing a lie. The antagonist may be someone who isn't going to go through that process. They're going to continue believing the lie. And so as a result, if the protagonist continues on the course they're taking, they may end up just like this antagonist. They may end up like that person. So, like, for example, Luke Skywalker in Star Wars has to learn how to control his emotions and grow up so he can be a Jedi Knight and a warrior. He has to learn to master himself so that he can fight evil. Darth Vader gave in to his emotions and as his father, and as a result, if Luke Skywalker doesn't master his emotions, he will end up becoming, you know, a Sith like his dad. And so that would be a great way to look at the two. But as far as what a villain is not necessarily someone who provides conflict, although they can be an antagonist. They're there to provide some level of threat. This can be a force. It can be a hurricane. It could be a disease. It can be my novel Our War, the war itself is the real villain. These are everyone else is just flawed people trying to survive it. But the Civil War itself is the villain in my story, and really the true antagonistic force, the meta antagonistic force. So when I look at antagonists and villains, I look at it very similarly to wrap up to Andy. Where the antagonist has a certain role to play and they can actually have a character arc themselves, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have a villain, which is more, could be the antagonist or it could be some other element in the story to make the hero, by contrast, look more heroic or to provide this sense of threat that in the setting or in the plot. I look at villains being more plot driven and antagonists being more character driven. That makes sense.
Interesting.
You know, and quite a few of my books and short stories, and I'm just thinking over everything now and how I do it, and I'm realizing that a lot of my stories don't have real, you know, quote unquote villains in them. But a lot of times my main character, my protagonist, is kind of creating problems for themselves. And the villainous aspects are actually inside their own heads, whether it's, you know, driving themselves mad like you'd expect out of a, you know, Edgar Allan Poe book, or they're making terrible decisions that are putting themselves in peril. And so, you know, where do you really find the antagonist in a story like that when there's not a clear, you know, this is supposed to be the good guy, this is supposed to be the bad guy, but the good guy is actually making just a whole shit heap for himself?
That has to do with the character arc, I think, because you're going after a you are your own worst enemy style of conflict. So, you know, two halves of yourself are at war with each other, and one has to win out in the end. They either grow through their character arc or they don't.
Yeah, I think even in a story where you're your own worst enemy, there will be at least a perceived antagonist. So, you know, that could be a situation where you have what's called the fake antagonist or fake enemy ally. And this is someone who you think is your enemy, but is actually trying to help you out. And so you could use something like that in that situation where, you know, I'm actually my own worst enemy and I have to overcome something. I'm actually my own antagonist, but I think you're my antagonist because you're stopping me from doing something that I shouldn't be doing. Right. And then later on, I learned, oh, it was me all along, or there was something in the environment like, oh, it's everybody else's fault, or it's this environment's fault, or my job's fault, or my boss's fault. They can all be antagonists because I'm the protagonist and that's how I see it. But in the end, I can learn that it was actually me. So in that hypothetical, that's how I would handle it.
But that sounds a lot like the teenager mentality we were discussing pre-show.
Yeah,
absolutely. Everybody else is the enemy. Now, what's interesting is that it's all a matter of perspective. And it's not evil is a matter of perspective in that sense, because, you know, evil is, it's sort of defined by the norms of society, right? But the antagonist's role is a matter of perspective. One of my favorite antagonistic roles from one of my series, the Hero of Darkness series, is priests. These are genuinely good, pious priests. They, you know, they feed the poor. Their sole mission in life is to improve the, you know, the world. All of the people who are there, they're genuinely good people. And yet, they are the antagonists in the story. They stab the main character in the heart and kick him off a cliff. Why? Because he's a demon and their mission is to hunt demons, right? Which is a great mission, which is a very heroic mission, hunting demon. But because of this perspective, it switches. Or in the Queen of Thieves series, the main antagonist is the law and order in the city. He's this upright, noble guy who all he wants is to bring peace to his city. But because the main character is a thief, he's the bad guy. And throughout all of their interactions, the only times that you ever get, oh, he's kind of a dick, is the way that he, like, he's so angry at her, or when you see him executing her friends, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not like, had you stepped back and seen it from another perspective, he would have been the villain. On the contrary, he's the good guy. But because it's this perspective shift, it really makes it interesting. And so by that, with that viewpoint, you can make anybody an antagonist. A couple of times I've done these panels talking about this, and I'm like, all right, pitch me your most heroic character. And people have said Superman. Superman is an easy one. Anybody, I mean, you know, look at the Superman versus Batman movie, right? Right there, it gives you a great example of how the greatest hero, Superman is probably one of the greatest heroes of all times, can become an antagonist. And so with that perspective shift, literally anything and anyone can go from just a normal character to a heroic character to an antagonist. Some friends of mine, Rhett Bruno and Jamie Castle, they write this series about this paladin and this thief. And the paladin is like this noble, upright, moral, virtuous person. And the thief is exactly what you'd expect. And so they're always in conflict because the one's views clash with the other one's. And it's something as simple as that. In the series, you know, they work together and save the world or whatever. But, you know, something like that, like religion, people can have two very different ideas of the same religion, and it starts them down this path to antagonism, where you end up with, you know, the kind of wars that we've gotten throughout history. Mm-hmm. So it's, you can take literally anything and turn it around like that and make it an antagonist, because antagonist has nothing to do with motive. All it means is someone who opposes the actions of the protagonist or the desires or what they're trying to do. So no matter who they are or what they are trying to accomplish, someone stands in their way, they are immediately an antagonist. Mike, this might shock you, but my favorite type of villain is not a person at all. Forces of nature are my favorite. Time, gravity, distance, you know, weather, things like that. It's so much fun to throw it in there because it's not the main villainous character. You know, you've got the bad guy or whatever, but it ups the tension of the book so much when the guy's got 45 minutes to travel a 3-hour distance. Right there, there's nothing he can do about this. So it's like these massive forces of nature, of the universe, are not conspiring against him, but it's these things that cannot be changed, that cannot be defeated. And it really makes it so much more interesting when the character actually does defeat them.
Well, let me ask you this. Okay, so have any of you seen the movie Dante's Peak?
Years ago.
Years ago, yeah. the volcano. Oh.
Pierce yes. Brosnan? Yeah. Yes, Pierce Brosnan, Volcano, Linda Hamilton. Okay, so this is our Clockwork Universe, is this volcano is going to blow, and in the end, it's going to destroy everything. You know, spoiler alert, it does. And so would you consider this volcano, is this the antagonist? Is this the villain of the movie?
Not the villain. One of them. Not the villain. So when I sort of came up with this concept, villain is described as someone who is like, I will look it up just to get, I just had it open. It's someone who is like actually evil, or Random House Unabridged Dictionary defines the word villain as a cruelly malicious person who is involved or devoted to wickedness or crime, scoundrel in a character or play or novel, who constitutes an important evil agency in the plot. So this sort of means that they are on the evil side of things. They are immoral. They break social norms. They do things that have been historically considered evil, like rape, murder, things like that, right? That is much more on the good versus evil side. An antagonist is simply something that is a threat or that opposes. So the volcano is not a villain at all, because there's nothing villainous about it. It is simply this massive force of nature that threatens the main character.
But if you wanted to play devil's advocate, you could say Mother Nature is wholesale destruction of towns, cities, people, lots of death and destruction by forcing the volcano to erupt.
But that is
villainous, but there's no intent.
That's giving a personality. Now, if there was an actual entity, right, in this story, no, called right. Mother Nature with the power, and who was who was using it to create this volcano and destroy things, then yes, she would be villainous.
So let me see if I've got this perspective shift right, because this is really actually pretty intriguing. And yes, Mike, you got it right. It is the volcano movie. Yes. Okay. So what I'm picturing, because you just said someone who's, raping or murdering and doing these terrible things. And I agree, that is a terrible situation. So we have this warlord. He has his army of bad guys, and he loves to do that kind of stuff. He loves to pillage and rape and murder. However, the story is from his point of view, and he's trying to defend against this other character that's trying to come in and defeat him. So by that logic, he would really be the protagonist of that story, and the other character would be the antagonist, right?
Absolutely. But again, it's not about protagonist and antagonist has nothing to do with personality, intention, any of that. It is simply these roles that they have been assigned by the author of the play, movie, book, whatever it is. So the Hero of Darkness series, half demon assassin, cursed dagger that drives him to kill. Pretty much that's classic bad guy 101. But because I, the author, have assigned him this role as the protagonist, now I've got to frame him as the better of the two evils. So he's still got, he's killing people, right? But let's give him a moral code where he only kills people that he believes deserves it. Okay, still evil, but we've got a little bit of leeway in there for that. We can accept that. Mm-hmm. Okay, he goes and he kills someone, finds out that they're trafficking women. All right, we're going to be okay with that, right? So we've taken two steps away from villainous killer to, okay, I can understand you killing bad people, and now here's a bad person you killed, so good on you for that. And then something else happens, and he kills more people. Evil actions are actions that would be traditionally villainous, but because of who he's killing and why he's killing, all right, we're okay with that. And more in there. So by the end of the first book, you're rooting for him to kill somebody. Murder is still very, very villainous, but you want him to kill someone because killing someone is the only way to stop something worse. So this is the kind of thing where you can use perspective. Now, there is a difference. Like, you can argue the difference between murder and, say, vengeance killing, justice killing, execution, all of that. We don't have time to get into those sort of moral and philosophical debates. But there are some things that audiences will never forgive, that can never be come back from, or it takes like extreme skill for an author to write a character who can come back from these things. Number one is rape, right? If your protagonist rapes someone, like actually doing it, not, some misunderstanding, like it's, you know, confusing nowadays, but like a straight up rape, most readers will never be able to accept him as or her as a protagonist. Again, they will always end up in the antagonist role. And that's how a lot of people show the villain's journey. They start off in this heroic place, whether they're knights or kings or whatever they are, and they slowly go down this path using desire for someone to show their descent into villainy so that at one point they cross a moral line that we as a society have deemed absolutely unforgivable and unacceptable, and that changes them from the heroic character into a villainous character. Now, they may still be a protagonist, but when they cross that line, most of us will never allow them to remain a protagonist. They immediately become an antagonist in our minds because they are doing something that we as humans cannot agree with, humans in our current society. So it's all this mindset that we're playing with. We are playing within the confines of society with a little bit of leeway to play with perspective, but in the end, you have to understand that there are certain things that society can never forgive.
Now, a lot of that has to do with creating empathy for the character by showing that character arc. So let's say they start off doing something evil, but not necessarily the unforgivable evil.
Yeah.
And then we show as their journey, you know, progresses, they end up doing things that redeem some of that in some way. They can still be a jerk. Yeah. They can still do bad things, but they're heading towards a good path by doing redeemable things that allows you to turn them from, I don't like this character, they're a villain, to, okay, I can kind of root for them. One of the best examples of that recently was the Kingslayer in Game of Thrones, how he started off being this horrible, horrible character. And by the end until, you know, don't watch the last season, but until the end, you know, he's actually somebody you're rooting for to see him survive and to see him finish his actual character arc, which they never let him do. But yeah, he started off pushing a kid out a window, sleeping with his sister. I mean, he was this horrible, horrible character who had to go through a hard redemption arc in order to become somebody you like.
But had Bran actually died, he would never have been redeemable. So rape, like, so there are some examples where rape is not an unforgivable thing. Mike, you mentioned Ragnar Lothbrok. I'm almost 100% certain at some point in the Viking series, he does, or some of the guys around him do actually rape some women, or, you know, they're reaving, they're raiding, and they hold someone down and have sex with them. And, you know, it's to show that's the right grittiness. And I know, but I'm like, so most of us now think of the more common types of rape as opposed to the sort of wanton raping and pillaging that was going on back then. So some things, like if it's in the context of society, of the society at the time, it's a fine line to walk that some people can actually like forgive that sort of thing because it was what was going on at the time. So it's not like the character actually made the decision so much like he went against social norms. It was just what everybody did at the time. The murder of children is another one. Most people will never forgive that. The murder of animals is another huge one. Like I actually had a reader tell me this in my third Hero of Darkness book, the character, he's, you know, this guy is charging at him, and they were like, is there any way to stop him from charging without killing the horse? There wasn't in the end. The horse had to die, but it's not like he was just like, he walked up and kicked a puppy. You know, this is one of those things that people will never forgive. And you can never really come back from. Jim, you mentioned Dexter. Dexter's a great example because from the beginning, Dexter had a line that he wouldn't cross. And I think that's one area where villains are separated from antagonists and from protagonists, that villains, the lines that they won't cross are farther towards the line of evil, towards the evil end of the spectrum. Dexter, his whole thing was he had to kill, but he's going to make sure that he kills people who deserve it. Yeah, as much as possible.
And I think that most of us who watched the show, we were all rooting for him. We were like, kill those bad guys.
Exactly.
We wanted it. But yeah, you know, another good example of, you know, the villain story that, you know, the villain is now the, you know, not, I'm not going to say hero, but now the protagonist is the very popular Maleficent. You know, those movies are very popular, and it's, you know, it's a character that was once the villain in the Disney cartoon movies, and now she has her own plot line, and
that's what we were talking about with perspective. Though she wasn't initially, she wasn't given any perspective. She was just shows up, curses a child, and that's it. When Disney decided to revamp her series, I guess, and give her some personality, that background story of why she did what she did really shifted everyone's perspective on what she was and what she represents. And she was no longer, you know, standard evil. Yes, she did something bad, but she also paid the price for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, is that perspective thing, it's really pretty eye-opening how much of a difference that makes. Now I do want to bring something up, because we're talking about the unforgivable curses here. And I'm talking to the old timers here, which would basically be me and you, Craig. Do you remember the Conan the Barbarian movies?
No, yeah.
Yes. Do you remember that early on in those movies, they would toss women into his cell for him to have his way with? Mm-hmm. And that's totally glossed over. And he's still the hero barbarian.
No, he's the anti-hero. Straight up anti-hero.
Anti-hero? Okay.
Yeah, 100%.
I was just thinking, man, nobody ever really talks about that stuff.
Well, we should talk about that, is since we're talking about, you know, villains, and we're talking about, you know, the protagonists and where the lines can be crossed. What about the anti-hero, which is extremely popular right now?
Hi, Craig.
I find that if I start punching it, it actually works. Like,
all right. So looking at Craig's situation, who is the protagonist and who would be the antagonist in Craig's situation?
We're the protagonists in this story.
Craig is the antagonist.
Wait a second.
Technology.
Technology is the villain.
And yes, and his computer is
villainous, the villain. Rather.
Yeah.
So anti-heroes. Oh, wait. Before we move on to anti-heroes, I've been wanting to ask this. Can either or all three of you give me an example of a true villain that everybody would know from pop culture? Give us a real villain.
General Zod. Well, no, he's an antagonist. He's not really villainous. Nero.
Okay.
And Nero from The Last Days of Pompeii, the Peter Ustinov Nero.
Oh, that's not a pop culture reference, man.
Well,
this is history.
How about the master?
That's the thing. So in the last decades, I guess, it's been really uncommon to find straight up villains, simply because we as a society have evolved to want to understand things. So when we see someone doing something villainous, it's really hard for us to say, oh yeah, they're just a villain. We want to understand why they're doing it. And so you have the evolution of the villain, like a movie like Joker. You know, the Joker, the character of the Joker from comic books, is actually as close to a straight up villain as it can be, but in a way he's the victim of his own mental illness, which kind of takes him away from the sense from villainy, because maybe the person he was before he got insane wasn't actually a villain, but now that he's been afflicted by this mental illness that affected his psyche, his neurology, whatever, he is now something that we perceive to be as villainous. So it's hard to drop people like that into the category of villains, because they're almost as much victims in their own lives as the people who they hurt.
And that's where
my answer would be Hannibal Lecter. I think Hannibal Lecter is a great villain. He is actually an ally to the protagonist in the story, but he's also extremely villainous. And what's great about him as a villain is, while he's not the end, he can be antagonistic in certain scenes, but it's on a micro level. It's not for the overall plot. He's more like a thematic support. Like, he thematically shows, like, this is the kind of world Clarice is now involved with, and this is what these serial killers are like. They have this philosophy, and there can be really evil, and it really sets up. It not only contrasts with her, but it also contrasts with Buffalo Bill, who's the true antagonist and villain in the story, because she hasn't gone really met him yet, and she's getting to know him by pieces. The Hannibal Lecter provides sort of a preview of that. This is, we're cut from the same cloth. We're both evil like this. And so I would look at him as like an ideal kind of villain.
Okay.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Joker, because I wanted to say something about that movie. I thought it was a terrific character study of a villain. But there's something about villainy. You can have a villain be villainous because of their actions and their thoughts and so on. But there's something about the villain and their relationship with the protagonist. So Hannibal Lecter is fascinating, not just because you see him going around being a cannibal, but because of his relationship with Clarice. She's innocent and naive. He's a psychologist and evil, and he manipulates her and pulls a lot of things out of her, this whole quid pro quo thing they have going on, which is absolutely fascinating. So I think it's important to have a some type of relationship. Now, what the Joker's missing is, I don't know, the sense of being powerful. I mean, he's mentally ill, and it makes him murder people. Yeah, he's villainous, but he's also a victim of mental illness. And he hasn't really run up against Batman yet. So he's doesn't have any real agency, and he doesn't, other than shooting people. And I think that if they are continue the series and he ends up meeting Batman and they become a protagonist and antagonist, where actually the Joker is the protagonist, I think it's going to be weak, because Batman, part of the villainy and part of the job of the villain is to make the hero look good. And part of the job of the hero is to make the villain look villainous. Batman fighting some mentally ill guy in a clown costume, it's so gritty and real that he lost his agency, a lot of his agency. So I wonder what they'll do with the next movie, but it just doesn't, it strikes me as that we want him to be a little bit more like a comic book villain, not too real. Because if it's too real, he just seems like some mentally ill guy with a gun.
There was a moment, though.
This is the guy who's going to thwart Batman? I don't see it.
There was a moment in the very end of the movie where when he stood up and he kind of had his arms out, you almost could sense that he was accepting his new role.
Well, and I haven't seen
it. Or he was embracing his fantasy that his mental illness, like, and that he's just mentally ill.
And
it strongly leads you in that direction.
So he wasn't truly the villain yet, but that was that moment where you're like, I can see he's about to take that next step and actively become the villain. Whereas right now, that movie that you saw was just all of the steps leading up to that moment.
Yeah, I think my ultimate satisfaction with that movie will have to be proven out in the sequel.
Well, so
it depends on his relationship with Batman. I'm sorry, go ahead.
It was intended to be a standalone. Like, I don't think there are going to be more sequels, or there was so far there's no rumor of sequels, because it's this sort of one-off. It's not the Joker that we know from the Batman comics. It's not the Joker who showed up in the Batman movies or in any of the TV shows. He's this version of the Joker that is terrifyingly real. Mm-hmm. And so that was the intention. And so playing it as the Joker is using the super popular character archetype and bringing it to life in a way that, you know, that audiences will devour. And I'd say it succeeded very, very well. But it's not the Joker that faces off against Batman in the sense of, like you said, he doesn't have the sort of agency that Joker has, because that Joker takes his villainy to a much greater extreme.
Mm-hmm. Well, and how do you separate those two? I mean, yes, I know they're not saying they're going to do a sequel, but you saw young Batman. So you saw how old he was. There's many years between that moment of the Joker, you know, accepting who he is now, and when Batman actually comes on the scene. There's a lot of stuff that can go in between that they're not showing you, but they led into it, I think, really well.
Mm-hmm. But I haven't seen it yet. I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm not a fan of Joker movies or Suicide Squad or much of the DC universe, but I'm really looking forward to this one because it looked like a really good story. And that's kind of what I'm all about. And I actually read Craig's post when he posted his short review on it about it being a great character study. And that's really what I'm more interested in is seeing someone take this character that I always just thought was kind of a crap character and really making something meaningful out of it. So, and I really like, and like I said, I haven't seen the movie, but I really like the mental illness aspect of it because I feel like it feels more real to me in a universe that is completely unreal to me. But yeah.
But if it does have familiar elements from the comics. And so in the back of our heads, we do have this prejudice that, hey, this guy's eventually going to fight Batman. And I just don't see it. I just, all I see is Batman, the world's greatest detective and crime fighter, is punching out this mentally ill guy who is living in his head. That's
Well, so the Joker that we all know and love is a guy who fell into this vat of terrible chemicals that twisted his brain to such an extreme degree that human brains could never really get there. So that Joker is a caricature of a human being, of the extreme of villainy that we could find ourselves going to. It's an impossible extreme. So that's the Joker who you want Batman to punch out. Right, he's the one who, when he beats Jason Todd to death or whatever, you want Batman to kill him because he is this extreme, this version that is impossible, and so it's something. But then this character, now that we've seen come to life, you can absolutely understand how he got there, and you can almost empathize and rationalize with him. So in that sense, it's much harder for us to say, yes, I'm okay with this, because we've followed along on his journey, and in a way, we were a little bit okay with it.
Yeah. Actually, I think that the Heath Ledger Joker was a much better villain. And the reason why is because he had a lot of agency, wildly unrealistic amount of agency, but this is a comic book movie. But what I really liked about him the most, again, was the villainy defined in the relationship with the other characters. So this is a guy who's worse than the mob. He's going to challenge the mob because the mob's actually quite orderly, but the Joker's not orderly. He's here to spread chaos. He doesn't care about money. He doesn't care about anything except challenging morals, which he feels are always fake and situational. And that makes him such a great contrast. Well, not just with the mob who he overthrows to take over crime in the city, but also against Batman himself, because Batman is all about law and order, and one rule is I don't kill people, and Heath Ledger's Joker is like, I'm going to destroy you by forcing you to face these insane ethical choices that are no-win situations, where you have to be very bad or a little bit bad, but I'm still going to stain you. And I just thought that was wonderful, and that makes him such a fantastic, not only antagonist, but a fantastic villain for Batman. And he elevates Batman through the contrast and vice versa.
Well, I agree with you completely. And I have another good one for you guys. And hopefully somebody in this panel has seen this. But Brandon Byers from Brightburn. Have any of you seen Brightburn?
I haven't seen that one yet.
Oh, my Lord. Well, we're not going to talk about Brightburn then. But guys, everybody go frickin' watch Brightburn right now. It's insane.
Is Brandon the kid?
Brandon is the kid.
And, yeah, the trailer kind of spells out what's happening.
Oh, yeah.
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but it was so, it was nice because it was so not necessarily mainstream, and it wasn't really what I was expecting, but just really, really cool, dark movie. But yeah, go watch it. That's another good one. And he's a character that I would consider a villain. Man, it's a bummer you guys haven't seen that. We'll have to chat about that another time. But then someone else, Anita, suggests Skynet.
So, you know, I don't know Skynet's purpose or its origin, but I can say that a lot of these, like, artificial intelligences that become evil are simply following their directive, because in essence, these artificial intelligences are programmed with something. Like, let's say, stop people getting sick, right? Or let's stop people from dying. Their goal is to heal people. That is their one directive.
No sickness.
What's that?
If there is no people, there is no sickness.
Exactly. That right there. Boom. It is a very, very simple explanation for a machine, a purely logical thing to reach a conclusion. So it's only because we can combine both logic and emotion that we as humans are able to think to make the decisions that we do. But something that is pure logic would be unable to understand that wiping out all humanity to save the Earth.
Yeah, well, in Skynet's programming, I'm going to go nerd on you here, Terminator nerd, because I really love those movies. Mm-hmm. Skynet was programmed to take over the U.S. military and to monitor the Earth and keep the Earth at peace. So Well, realizing, okay, the big problem here is the humans. Yeah, that's what happened. But, you know, I mean, it's one of those where maybe if you shift a perspective on that and we were telling it the other way around, maybe the humans would be the bad guys in this situation.
Well, it would be a lot harder to tell that kind of story because we as humans resonate with emotion. And that is a purely logic-driven action and response. So the only way that we could get that is if the AI in question ultimately develops that sense of humanity to understand the emotional aspect of things. If it starts out as a cold, emotionless computer program that's all ones and zeros, which is exactly what it is. It's scripted to follow one very specific command, and it just replicates itself and advances itself to do that better and better and better. But at the end, if it becomes human, it connects with us, the viewer or reader, on an emotional level by coming to that sort of emotional realization and fulfillment, then yes, we as the reader can see them as the protagonist. Now, if they never do it, and at the end of the book, they get shut down by the antagonist, who is actually the hero stopping them from destroying the world, it's this weird perspective shift that the character that we're reading along with is actually the villain of the piece, as opposed to from the protagonist's perspective.
But, hit it harder, Craig. Hit it harder.
That's what I'm actually doing that. Skynet shut me down. I was about to say something about Skynet. I
heard you talking about
it. I defeat it, and it's trying to shut me up.
So Mike Faria.
Oh, Mike's got a great one.
Yeah, one of his favorite villains was Kevin Spacey in Seven. And then Jim said Kaiser Soze in the
This Hebrew is the one. Yeah. Kaiser Soze, he's not evil. Like, he's far from being a villain. He's an antagonist, but man, he's awesome.
Oh, yeah. That was such an enjoyable movie. And we won't talk too much about it because that's one where you can only see it once and then you know the spoiler.
Yeah.
But Kevin Spacey in Seven. Mike, that movie fucked me up. I first saw it because I was a young man and I didn't realize how much of an emotional impact that was going to have on me because I'm a little too sensitive to that kind of thing. And holy crap, did that mess my head up. But yeah, and I can't even remember what his, because he was just a John Doe, I think he was his name in that movie, Kevin in Seven. But yeah, Kevin Spacey in Seven, he was a great bad guy. Holy crap, because it gave me shivers. It messed me up afterwards. I couldn't think about it. Don't you give me quotes from it, Mike. That's not nice. That's not nice. What's in the box? What's in the box? You know, I watched that with Abby, my 17-year-old, not long ago. And when we get done, and she's talking about Brad Pitt, she was like, man, he's a really shitty actor, isn't he? And I'm like, what? It's Brad freaking Pitt from the 90s. That was his game, A game right there.
Anyhow. I read this interesting article about him, sort of deviating from the topic, where he's got the looks of an A-list actor, but he's got the acting chops of a supporting man. The looks of a lead, but the acting chops of a supporting role. So if you look at all of his best movies, every single one of them is when he's not the focal point, but he's the one who's holding up. I mean, take someone up above mentioned Fight Club. 100% very likely his best role, and he was not the main man.
Oh no,
he complements the characters. A lot of people gave him really good reviews for his performance in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And again, he's not the main character. He's got this role that's supporting, and it makes it so interesting.
Well, and somebody in the comments here mentioned Gary Oldman, and he always plays great bad guys, but he can play great bad guys, great good guys, anything, man. That dude is amazing. But you know, he's never really been just the villain. You know, he's always just kind of been the guy who's making the wrong decisions in everything. You know, and I agree with you, Mike. World War Z was kind of a yawn fest to me too. But World War Z, do we have a villain there with the zombies? Are they villains?
They're antagonists. They are mindless, unthinking beasts, forces of nature, right? Or not forces of nature. They are human excesses taken to an extreme. Take vampires, lust, right?
Mm-hmm.
Vampires are lust brought to life, not just the lust, you know, the physical, like the original creation, the Bram Stoker's Dracula, but then like a gluttony almost, you know, this extreme need to feed.
Craig kind of looks like a vampire to me a little bit. Just a little.
Werewolves. They were this, you know, the humans, the anger, sort of the emotions taken to an extreme. They are hunger. They're all these things. And so the zombies are also taken to an extreme as well. They're this personification of mindless consumerism that has become super popular, this need to consume things. It's super silly when you say it out loud, but when you start thinking about it, you realize that there is this never-ending hunger that would, like, it'll never be satisfied. And so you can, like, if you look at the world today, you can see why zombies have become so popular, because even though they are consuming human flesh, in the same sense, they really give us this insight into ourselves, how, yes, we buy that new thing, that's really awesome, but eventually it's going to wear off, and then we're going to want something more. And so we've sort of evolved as a society to have that in a way that people, you know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 1,000 years ago would never have had. And so these monsters adapt and evolve according to our society. And they're sort of this perspective on what happens when the human weaknesses and flaws are taken to any extreme.
And you guys are so freaking smart.
Seven deadly sins almost.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I like that.
Now, I want to do something here, because we've got about 10 minutes left. And I want to know, and I mean, I'm sure we've all had this question before, but who is your favorite bad guy that you didn't create? Somebody else's creation. Who's your favorite bad guy? Katie, why don't you go first?
I like the Master from Doctor Who.
Oh. Character himself was awesome. But the episode 12 appearance to go back in time and start everything that happens from episode 1 of that season, that blew my mind. Changed my approach to writing stories.
Yeah.
What episode was it?
In one of the seasons, there's this sort of FBI organization hunting Doctor Who throughout the whole season, right? They show up and they're hunting him. They try to convince his companion to turn on him, the companion's family. And in episode 12, he runs into the Master. The Master steals his TARDIS, travels back in time to before the season started, essentially, and like 9 months earlier, and founds the organization that has been hunting him the entire time. It was just like, it blew my mind, because that is a degree of foresight that it was, you know, I don't think I've seen that anywhere else.
Yeah, he pulled off well, she as well, because when he turns into Missy, she became an even more villainous and wonderful creation.
Yeah.
I like that they could take everything to the extremes in the worst case scenario with the ability to pull anything they want off. That whole time travel angle just makes it so much fun. But then you run into all the paradoxes that it would create.
Well, what about you, Craig? Favorite bad guy out there?
I don't have I'm not one of those guys who has single favorite anything. And I always panic with questions like this, because I'm like, what about? I gave the wrong answer. But you know, so a bunch of the ones we talked about tonight would come to mind easily. You know, Hannibal Lecter. When I was younger, Darth Vader was my favorite, absolutely. And sometimes I have favorite antagonistic forces, like I'm big. You know, I was a big fan of zombie books for a while, zombie movies. So zombies were a terrific antagonist. And in Seven, you know, the John Doe character was a terrific villain as well. So, yeah, I've got a bunch. And I like them each for a different thing, you know, so it's highly situational.
What do you think, Andy?
You know, I was going to say Darth Vader, the Darth Vader from the original series. He was this sort of, the original three movies. He was this sort of looming presence and not evil, you know? You never really got the sense of evil from him. Just this sort of not all powerfulness, but just imposing, domineering will, this unstoppable person. And that is something that is very, very difficult to portray or to write into stories. You know, just someone who is this all-consuming, almost a force of nature in their own right. And then over the course of the story, they gave him a humanity that didn't in any way detract from just how powerful a Jedi or Sith or whatever, you know, how his power and his agency in the story and in the universe. And I think that's probably one of the best crafted antagonists or villains that I've.
I think agency had a lot to do with it. He's the most powerful person in the first three movies.
Well, like the, I think the Emperor, they make it clear the Emperor is more powerful than him. As
his, you don't see the Emperor do that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but like, as you know, the fact is he can't survive a battleship blast or, you know, a crash, or, you know, he goes into the sun and he's dead. You know, there is limits to his power.
Right.
But you know, when you see him walking past all of the stormtroopers lined up, or when you see him, you know, choke out the general who's, you know, piloting this massive battleship, or he's the one
at the end of Rogue One.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really kind of brought it back, the old.
Oh, that was such a powerful scene at the end of Rogue. Oh.
Exactly. Exactly. Rogue One did Darth Vader right, because they showed just how imposing and terrifying of a person he was. And that, and yet at the end of the, at the end of it, he dies to save his son in an absolutely believable journey. And throughout that whole journey, he never lost his sort of awe inspiring.
And it wasn't too sappy at the end either. And I think that's what let him keep all of that darkness, is because it wasn't too drawn out. It was just, it was like, okay, we can believe this, but we're not overwhelmed with this. This didn't erase everything that he did, because he was a fucking bad guy.
I love that look when you watch the movie and you see him look at the Emperor and look at his son and look at the Emperor. It's that parent moment right there. You're like, oh, fuck, here.
Yep. But no, and I think that Darth Vader and Hannibal Lecter are probably, I mean, and I'm a lot like Craig. I don't really have a favorite, but those two are just, they're so well crafted, and they just, they stick with you forever. I will never forget either of those guys as long as I live. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and you know, and Mike said the bad guy in No Country for Old Men, he was terrifying with his little, whatever that air bolt was thing that he had that he used to kill people. That was scary. Yeah, man, villains, lots of good stuff. Hi, Leah. Thanks for
our villains favorites. Is there's a lot of empathy behind them. We understand the villains we like. So they stick in our mind a lot more than just, say, cookie cutter villains or villains who haven't really been given enough of a backstory to care about. We're just happy that the protagonist won. It's those villains that we really understand that we're going, yeah, these are the villains I like. These are the ones I want to watch again.
Or even I would say to a different degree, the ones who are just so memorable, like the Joker. How many people do you know, white face, you know, massive thing, green hair? And I mean the Joker from the comic books. You know, that is a memorable character, no matter which way you cut it. You are never going to forget the Joker with his cackling and with his ridiculous traps and poisons and stuff, you know, things like that. Or Lex Luthor. That's another one that, you know, even before you understood his motivation and his backstory with Superman, the things he did, the threat he represented, the size of his role in the world, he is a very, very memorable character that, of course, over time, they gave him a backstory where, you know, they humanized him and that made him more interesting. But even from the very beginning, they were both very memorable characters.
Well, and I think that, you know, if there's one thing that we can really take from this, and that anyone watching or listening can take from this, is that we don't necessarily need villains in our books, in our movies, in our poems. We need good antagonists. We need good characters that are really well fleshed out, that have a backstory, that have a purpose. And you know what? If they happen to be the bad guy of that book, that's okay, because in a different book, they might be the good guy. You know, so make those characters so well-rounded that they could be the good guy in a different book, or at least the protagonist, because I've learned today that good guy, bad guy, protagonist, antagonist, villains, those are all very different things.
Yeah.
They can be the same thing, or they can be different things, and it really depends on what the story needs.
We didn't get to talk about the anti-hero, or could we call them the villainous protagonist?
Ooh, I like that sound.
Anti-heroes are actually a lot simpler than people expect. You basically put them right on the border of good versus evil. And then anytime you nudge them towards evil, you nudge them two steps back towards good. And so you basically take them down a very, very short or a very small path to redemption. Not, you know, all of a sudden saving the world by being a hero. But, you know, by killing so-and-so, they saved the world, right? That's an example. their actions don't necessarily have to become more heroic in any sense of the word, but by doing the right thing at the right time, that's all it takes to make them heroic in that sense.
Okay, Andy. Okay.
Right. They can do bad things for something good. Like Dexter is a...
Yeah.
Oh, man, he's great. I love him.
So okay. Transactional good then?
What's that?
Transactional good?
Yeah. Yeah, essentially. He could still be a mass murderer. As long as he mass murders the people, essentially, who the right people in the story
that you pursue,
we can be okay with it.
So how about this? The movie Swordfish. Has anybody heard of that?
Heard it? Yeah, that's the hacker one.
Oh,
My God in heaven! You guys, you have two movies on your list now: Brightburn and Swordfish.
Well, right? A great anti-hero would be Mel Gibson in Payback.
There you go.
Oh, I love that one.
For the bad guy.
I love that.
Yeah, he's a very bad guy, but he's got has a basic moral code, and he does.
And he goes and kicks the shit out of the worst guys.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Or the Punisher. The Punisher is one of my favorite anti-heroes because at the end of the day, he is still straight up murdering a lot of people. But because of who these people are, we're okay with it. We, the reader. Mm-hmm. And so that's basically all an anti-hero is someone who's doing the wrong things for the right reasons, or ultimately the right reasons that we, the reader, accept as right. And so this is something that that we as writers need to understand, is that the reader's moral sort of rules are going to change over the course of history. Like take Conan, right? When you were talking about them throwing the women into his cell for him to have his way with. When Robert Howard first wrote Conan, I'm not going to say that was morally acceptable at the time, but No. Robert Howard was like almost 100 years ago now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm still thinking of the movie.
Okay. So, for example, feminism was not a thing yet. Equality, not a thing. So that sort of thing was written at a very different time.
And they were pulp stories, which were all wish fulfillment stories.
Exactly. And it was all to a male audience and all of that. So the stuff that we're writing now, 20 years from now, 100 years from now, people are going to be like, what the shit were these people thinking? They're writing about... Oh my God! You know who knows what the next
We're gonna have to change the name of the Andy Pelliquin Award.
There you go. But so right now, if you look back at the biggest changes in the last few hundred years, you've got equality, the lesbian and gay rights, the LGBTQ alphabet soup, all of that. You've got the black rights. You've got women's rights. These are the last three huge changes in society. If you read any literature set before women's rights, you're not going to see any of that. If you read any literature from before the black rights, you're not going to see any of that. So all of these things, these huge social evolutions, they shape the course of fiction because we, the authors, are catering to people who live within these societies now. So the kind of things that was just common practice 100 years ago is going to be absolutely unthinkable 200 years from now, just like the kind of thing that was done in the 17, 1600s. We're like, how could they be so barbaric to think that that's socially acceptable?
Interesting.
So the definition of anti-hero sort of changes slightly according to the society in which we live.
Okay. Now that makes sense. And Mike thinks that, we need to bring back the tragedy. Mike, if you want tragedy, wait for my new book to come out, Flutter of Darkness. There's plenty of it in there.
I have to say, there's a counterpoint to that, because a lot of people, and going back to the Joker movie specifically, a lot of people were unhappy about the Joker movie because of how it ends, because it's not a...
Don't tell me how it ends. I haven't seen it.
It's not a yay ending. And people want a yay ending, especially in times of turmoil. They don't want to feel bad when they go out for entertainment. So a lot of times you'll see tragedies become more vogue when there's less problems happening, because it's the opposite effect. We want what we're not experiencing. And when we're having a society that's very downtrodden, a lot of bad things happening, we want things that make us feel better when we watch them or read them.
Yeah, I can see that. I like to watch... I like to watch gritty crime shows and really dark stuff, but I always really like it when there's a positive resolution, because then you don't feel like crap at the end of it like you did the whole time.
We as humans, we have to deal with the shitty outcome every single day of our lives. So when we have that happy ending, it's like, all right, this makes me feel a little bit better about the reality that I now have to go and return to.
For me, it's like anything else. If it's done well, it's done well. Like Seven could be considered tragedy. That's one of the most brilliant movies ever made.
I think American History X also has a tragedy ending.
Yep.
As well. And yet an amazing movie that they inspire, or they're very thought provoking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, you don't really realize the genius of the movie, especially with those two, until you're finished with it. And then you sit back and you're like, whoa. That was amazing. Well, guys, we are at the end, and in fact, we're a little bit beyond our time tonight. But I want to thank you both again for coming on tonight. You two are just wonderful to have on the show.
Well, thanks for having us.
Yeah, that was fun. Happy, guys, and you are welcome back anytime. We'll have to schedule another one of these.
that'd be great.
Yeah, that'll be fun. We'll have to find another good topic to get into here.
Right. So.
Thwart Skynet from keeping me off.
Yeah.
All right. Well, from all of us here on Spilling Ink and Leah the Cat, we wish you a very pleasant Saturday evening. Now she's taken off. Now she's done with me. So if you like the show, like it or share it or subscribe, anything that you can do. And we'll see you next time. See ya.
Thank you.
Oh, I wasn't ready to hit the button, guys. Sorry.